I think the consciousness is actually much more like music than it is a computer. And I often tell my AI and neurocomputational colleagues and foes that you guys are like, it's like going to the symphony and all you're hearing is a low percussion, very low frequency bass. Buh, buh, buh. You're not hearing the piccolos. You're not hearing anything, really. You're just down at that low bass. You're missing the whole thing. They don't like that, of course, but I think it's valid. And I think that, you know, within the next 2 years, we're going to, I think everything's going to shift towards higher frequency, and EEG will become obsolete. EEG as it stands now will become obsolete.
What do you think of out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences? So many cases through time, some very credible cases. One that comes to mind is Dr. Eben Alexander, who was a neurosurgeon, died on the operating table, came back, had a life-altering experience that turned him from a rationally grounded skeptic in science to someone who tours the world to talk about God and the afterlife. How do you view these experiences for your own personal model of reality, of consciousness?
Very similar stories of near-death experiences go back thousands of years. Every culture that I know of has reported them, and they're all pretty much the same. There's a white light, there's a tunnel, there's a sense of calm, they meet deceased relatives and so forth, and it's the same in every culture. And I think what happens is if consciousness shifts to a higher frequency, you get faster, smaller, and you get below the level of atoms even, and you're in space-time geometry where you get non-locality. Back around 2000 or so, the first studies on near-death experiences in medicine came out from Pim van Lommel and Peter Fennec. And they all had pretty much the same description. They all found the same percentage of cases and so forth, and the stories were all very similar. So the BBC at that time did a story about this, and because it was all pretty new at the time. Well, it had been around for thousands of years, but people hadn't. But in science, it was new. And they asked Pim van Lommel and Peter Fennec how to explain this. And they said, we have no idea. Ask Penrose and Hameroff because they have this crazy idea. And Roger didn't really want to go there. But I said, okay, well, what could happen is when the blood stops flowing and the oxygen is no longer available, the quantum information in the microtubules in space-time geometry, which is what's happening even in normal conditions, kind of can dissipate to the universe at large, space-time at large, but remain entangled as a unitary entity and persist. And if the patient is resuscitated, goes back inside, if the patient is not resuscitated, then can maybe continue, maybe find another set of microtubules in reincarnation. We don't know. But so my position is that near-death, out-of-body, afterlife, and reincarnation are not impossible. I don't claim evidence for it. I'll leave that to other people. I got enough things to get attacked about. But I do think they're possible. My own personal opinion is that they do occur. And the way that can happen is that the consciousness is occurring at the level of space-time geometry, which is what Roger said right from the 1989, his book, The Emperor's New Mind. So I think they're plausible, and I've written about that too.
And what about the often laughed at, although certainly being readdressed with a little bit more of an intense scrutiny, the concept of psi abilities, extrasensory perception, telepathy, remote viewing, you know, the idea that our own consciousness is not restricted to the body, but can in some way traverse mediums of energy to observe information, not localized to their specific coordinates in space and time, we could say, but are in some way accessing a form of information highway where linearity collapses, all moments are essentially observable. Do you hold space for that?
I think that's right. I think it happens. I don't claim proof of or evidence for that. Like I said, I got nothing to defend. But I've seen enough and heard enough and had my own experiences to think that that does occur. And if consciousness is it's non-locality, it's quantum entanglement. So, entanglement between two separated things. So if you make a measurement here, this one feels it instantly. This was predicted in quantum mechanics, and Einstein didn't like that at all. They called it spooky action at a distance. And yet it was proven in 1986. It was shown in an experiment by Alan Aspect in Paris. And soon after that, everybody, the hotshot physicists around the world, were showing entanglement between mountaintops, from a satellite, underground cables, all this and that. And, how do you explain that? Einstein couldn't explain it. Roger, by... in 1998 or so, Roger co-organized a conference at the Royal Society in London on entanglement. And by that time, all these young hotshots in physics had shown all these things. Entanglement existed. And it was being implemented in technologies, you know, quantum computing, quantum cryptography, quantum teleportation, all this and that. And, you know, so the basis of it is entanglement, which is now explained through wormholes, but I'll come, a little bit. But so the classic experiment is if you have a superposition of two complementary particles here, and you send one of them here and one of them here, if you make a measurement on this one up here instantaneously reacts. This is the EPR, Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, because they made this thought experiment to show how absurd it was. He said, if you did that and measure here or measure here, this one would feel it instantaneously faster than light. So that's obviously impossible. And so it was kind of attempted refutation in a thought experiment. But Aspect did the experiment, and it worked. It showed. And then all these other guys. And so at this meeting, and then Roger invited me, and I gave a talk. It was really a thrill and an honor. All these hotshot physicists are going, who the heck are you? What are you doing here? And you know, I told him what about the microtubules and stuff like that. By the end of the meeting, everybody was pretty stoked on the fact that these had been shown, but utterly clueless how it could happen. So Roger got up at the very end of the conference. I'll never forget this. And he had a blackboard, and he showed the EPR experiment, the two things here, this here, this here, you make a measurement. He said, how is it that you make a measurement here? This one over here feels it, reacts instantly. He said, I think the answer is obvious, but nobody up to this time has mentioned it because I'm the only one here who's already a member of the Royal Society. And saying what I'm about to say would get you guys banned forever because it's so absurd. But I'm going to do it anyway because, you know, I'm Roger Penrose. So he said, if you make a measurement here, you get information going backward in time to when the two were together and then forward. And that's how it happens. Put the chalk down, and that was the end of the meeting. And I was blown away. I'm going, oh, my gosh, you just explained entanglement. But you need backward time effects. But there was a strong history for that, backward time effects, at least for short periods of time. So entanglement. I think we need that, and non-locality can be part of. I think we need non-locality entanglement in the brain. Forget about outside the brain, but just this side of the brain to that side of the brain, you get this perfect gamma synchrony coherence. And how do you do that? You can't do it by neural signals. Ephaptic fields don't work because they trail off with distance. And so I think we need quantum entanglement in the brain to explain spatiotemporal binding. Zero phase lag, gamma synchrony, all these electrophysiological effects, and people are only now beginning to look at the simultaneity, whether they're occurring instantly together. So I think there has to be entanglement in the brain, and I think fundamentally the brain, consciousness at least, is a quantum system embedded in a classical system of microtubules.
That's a very good way of putting it. You know, I'm not sure where I sit on the scale of spirituality, but I do believe reality itself is in some way coherent, responsive, fluidic. Its ability to, in some way, respond to an observer and an observer state of being, I would say. And I don't dismiss the synchronicities that have occurred in my life. And I've seen things with my own eyes in sober states that defy our current knowledge. And I believe we are incredibly restricted by our societal apertures, not just our physical apertures, our dogmas, both in spirituality and in science. And yet the microtubules that could represent this fundamental point of convergence for the rise of consciousness, they too are not exempt from mystical correlation and cosmic importance. They exhibit a fractal geometry, self-similarity of scale in alignment with the geometric mirroring that occurs from microcosm to macrocosm, and makes me think of the ancient maxim of the great Hermetic sage of Egypt, Hermes Trismegistus, who said, as above, so below, as within, so without. You know, there is a sacred symmetry that has been recognized throughout time by our mystics and sages, only to be rediscovered, as you just said, much later by the rational minds of science. What does that say about intuition versus logic?
Good question. So let me go back a bit. When Roger first proposed objective reduction, when the collapse occurs due to an objective threshold, and so when that occurs, you get a moment of conscious experience. He said, when this occurs in the random microenvironment all around us, this moment of consciousness would be random, so disconnected. And we called it proto-conscious. We wrote another paper in 1996 for the Hard Problem issue of Journal of Consciousness Studies. And we said, when this occurs in the random microenvironment, the experience, the qualia that occurs then would be random and disconnected. So it would come and go, and we'd never know about it. And it's presumably happening everywhere around us, in the air, in the table, and everything. But it's kind of like background noise or proto-conscious noise. And this time sounds bizarre, but if you're a panpsychist, you think that everything has consciousness. So it's kind of the same thing, except it's proto-conscious. So, and it's kind of like going back to the symphony metaphor. If you go and the musicians are tuning their instruments before the performance, yeah, they're tuning it to A, but to the untrained ear, it sounds like noise and a cacophony of noise. So that's kind of like the proto-conscious noise that's going on everywhere, and we don't notice it. It's just there. It's probably a low threshold, but it's proto-conscious. So we need something in biology to quite literally orchestrate these objective reduction events and turn the proto-conscious noise into Beethoven or Brahms or the Beatles or whatever. And that's what the microtubules do. And that's what converts proto-conscious noise to consciousness. So there's two points there. One is we're surrounded by this proto-conscious noise. But for spirituality, you'd want something that's out there that we can access that has knowledge, wisdom, guide, you know, divine guidance, something like that, or Akashic record in Hindu, or what Roger called Platonic realms. And that's a little bit different. That would require some kind of self-organization in the universe of these proto-conscious events. That's not necessarily implied in the Orca-Aura theory, but it could be. I mean, it's certainly consistent with that these proto-conscious events somehow self-organize outside of biology and in the universe somehow. And I think that's possible in a number of ways to give something like, I don't want to use a word God. As Roger once said, I don't find it a useful concept. That's what he told me. I said, okay. But some kind of wisdom that's out there that might be guiding. And he called it Platonic values. So if you're mindful and don't act rashly and kind of meditate a little bit, your choices will be, and perceptions will be influenced by these Platonic values embedded in the universe. So it would be another step to say it's God, but it's possible.
Edging closer towards the big G word that no scientist wants to utter. It's a profound balance between what I would say are actually just two different ways of perceiving the same thing, you know, the lens of spirit and the lens of science, or intuition and logic. And you have to also acknowledge that some of the greatest minds in science, their intuitions are what we remember. And these are the things that are so easily dismissed until obviously empirical evidence can lay it out for everyone else. But there is certainly a level of importance to put on the fact that regardless of proving it later on, someone intuited this incredible knowledge. How, you know, where is that information?
Right. Well, it could be in the Planck scale. It could be, you know, in the fine scale structure of the universe. So we have no idea, actually. Roger worked on this with Paul Todd and some other guys, and using, I can't explain it, but it was the Schrodinger-Newton equation, which gave you the possibility of information embedded in the space-time. Chemists in the 18th century, I think, knew about hydrocarbons with chains of carbons and hydrogens, alkanes and alkenes, and they all had a formula. They're all linear chains. And yet, then they had this molecule C6H6, and they didn't know what it was structurally. They called it benzene. It was oily and flammable. And Kekulé, a German chemist, had a dream one night that the alkanes were snakes, and one snake swallowed its tail. And this is a mythical thing called the Ouroboros. And this formed a ring. And he woke up and said, aha, eureka. I mean, that was somebody else. But he said, aha, benzene is a ring.
I'm so happy that you brought up the vision of the Ouroboric serpent being intuited, because it's just another example of where exactly is this information rising up from. Another pretty significant example is René Descartes, because he apparently had a vision of an angel that came to him in a barn in Prague in a fever dream and gave him these ideas of measurement and number. So again, it just calls back to this strange mysticism. And why is it that when the brain decoheres, when all of this, you know, when this frequency increase potentially occurs and you're entering into a more quantum state, why the spirituality, why the mysticism, why the deities and advice?
Yeah, I think we access what Roger would call the Platonic realm, what the ancient Hindus or Vedics call Akashic record. Well, there's lots of names for it. And I think, you know, it's out there, and yeah, we can access it, and perhaps, probably more so, the more quantum we get, the faster and more non-local we get in our microtube.
But that's the thing, right? Because you kind of posit that you feel that consciousness maybe is the original spark, but almost in a primal form that is not, that there's not some sort of like source mass of intellect. But then when you have these experiences, it almost does feel like you're being faced with a massive intellect of some form.
Right. You know, as I said before, that's a whole nother step in terms of commitment. Claiming God that I don't need to take right now. And I take Roger, you know, I don't find it a useful concept, which probably means that it'll just get us in a lot of trouble. Just, you know, we've gone far enough. But it does support, you know, a mechanistic spirituality. I'll admit that. And I've actually written about that, although, you know, like I said, I got enough problems defending what I've said.
True, but you know, I do get the sense that this is the kind of territory the modern day science is going to have to step into, especially as we refine these quantum models. And regardless of AI's ability to be conscious, its assistance alongside us with accelerating research, I feel that we will start edging towards this uncomfortable place in science and physics where people are having to say, well, we don't really want to call this God, but is getting very close. And it was Terence McKenna that said the skeptics of a consciousness within nature will argue that this is simply the unfolding of developmental processes over time. But we have to ask the question, what are developmental processes? Why does the universe have a preference towards increasing the complexity of systems whilst it almost is simultaneously breaking down? Entropy is present, and yet so is developmental complexity. It's almost as if there was some form of mad rush to achieve something before the end of time.
Yeah, you mentioned Terence McKenna, and we're talking about psychedelics. And let me just tell you about one discovery in that area. That so we've been covering psychedelics in the Science of Consciousness conferences from way back. And first, it was a bit taboo, but now it's becoming popular. And so in 2012, Robin Carhart-Harris, who's a big researcher in that area, you probably heard of him, he did a study on human volunteers in an MRI scanner and an EEG. And so they'd be in the MRI scanner, and they had an IV, and they were asked to just lie there with their eyes closed. So no task, no input. And they gave them intravenous psilocybin. Psilocin, it's called. The active ingredient is psilocybin. And I think, you know, they were expecting the MRI to light up like a pinball machine, you know, when they gave the psilocybin, because all this stuff would be going on. So, but they asked them, you know, just lay quietly, tell us later what your experience was. Because if you're speaking, that's going to show up, you know, just the act of speaking. So just lie there quietly, tell us later what you were, and while we give you this, we'll give you the psilocin. And so they did that study, and the subjects reported later that they were having these vivid hallucinations, vivid experience. They're basically tripping. But the MRI, strangely enough, was cold and dark, as if they were comatose. And there was very little metabolic activity. They were at a loss to explain this. Robin, something about entropy and this and that, but it didn't really make sense to me. And so I said, well, I think I was chairing the session back then. I said, well, could it be that consciousness is happening at a deeper quantum level, which is actually very low energy? I think consciousness is actually low energy. You need all the energy in the brain for the transmembrane currents, the ion, the pumps, the ion channels, and that sort of stuff. That requires energy. So neuron firing, that's all highly energy consumptive. But consciousness at a deeper level might not, and therefore it's the last thing to go when the brain fails, which is why we might have this end of life brain activity. The heart stopped. There's no blood pressure, or almost no blood pressure, and the patient is clinically dead, And the EEG usually they use these processed EEGs, kind of goes to zero, and then after the heart has stopped, there's all of a sudden this burst of activity, which looks like gamma synchrony EEG, 30 to 90 seconds, and then it's gone. And this is called end-of-life brain activity. This was pioneered by a guy named Lakmir Chawla, and then it was done by people in anesthesia in post-cardiac death organ donation, where they wanted to make sure the patient was brain dead. This has been a fairly reproducible event. Not 100%, like 50% of patients show this when you measure it. And there's recently a full EEG on a patient. Jimo Borjigin is going to talk about this at our conference, who happened to have a full EEG going when the patient died, and they kept it going, and they saw it. They saw the everything go away, and then you got this activity when there was no blood pressure, no heart rate. So that could be the near-death experience, or it could be the soul leaving the body, perhaps. And you know, skeptics would say, well, it's just the last gasp of neurons firing, and it's an illusion, or this or that. You know, I understand how some people think consciousness is an illusion, but I don't know who would be having the illusion. That's a whole nother story. So anyway, this end-of-life brain activity could explain the out-of-body. It could be this could. We don't know for sure, but it does happen. And the point is, it shows that consciousness is actually probably a very low energy process, and the last to go when a patient dies. So I think it's probably true. So that would explain why psilocybin in an emotionless patient actually shows very little brain activity.
Hey everyone, this is a very important announcement. I am moving all of my long format content, meaning my full-length interviews, presentations, and productions, over to Rumble. YouTube has refused to remonetize my account despite every effort on my part to fix the issue, and I've now come to the conclusion that I am being purposefully blacklisted and censored. If you want to watch the full-length version of this interview, click the link in the description box or the one pinned to the top of the comment section and check me out on Rumble. Please subscribe. I'm having to rebuild from the ground up on Rumble, which, as you can imagine, is stressful and difficult. So your support means everything. Follow the link to check out the full-length interview and hit the subscribe button to show your support. All of my long-format content, full interviews, will now be exclusively on Rumble. Thank you.